Accession number 27804, Scotanita Ian Blair, Reel 13. Now, we're just talking. You just got a couple more things to add to the tales of that raid on El Adem.
When we, as I said, we made this attack on long, low-level power, and we fired at these guys on the ground and the aircraft that were running up on the ground, and then the aircraft did a 180-degree climb and turn to turn around and come back. And when we turned around and came back, there was the Italian Air Force CR-32s in perfect formation, away down sun, but they were very high, and they started their attack, diving down in echelon. So I remember the first time I ever fired my guns in anger, so to speak. I remember the tracking this aircraft as it descended, and I said early on that you're indoctrinated in your training, and I remember quite clearly it coming into my mind that I must track this aircraft down at an angle of 45 degrees, and when it enters the ringing bead site, open fire, as I've been taught at gunnery school, which I mentioned early on. And sure enough, and as this guy came down, he must have been, if he was a yard, he must have been at least 300 yards away. And without any tracer, I just opened fire on this guy. It seemed illogical at the time, opened fire on this guy. And he broke off instantly. And it flashed through my mind at the time, and I quote, "This air fighting's a piece of piss," unquote. But the next 20 minutes, we were pursued at a low level by the opposition, and we really sweated it out. But as I've said, I was almost about to unlock the guns and exercise my extra 10 degrees deflection, which he wouldn't have been expecting, but fortunately he broke away. The debrief was nothing. We just went through the system, and that was it. So,
and what happened next then? You know, you got back from your first raid. What happens?
Well, you had this debrief, and you started all over again, literally, to service, waiting for the next. And I think it must have been about that time, maybe they started to take the bomb doors off and put fragmentation bombs on, which didn't please anybody at all. But it went on from that. Was the standard drill. You carried fragmentation bombs or you operated. But our squadron, 113 Squadron, was the furthest advanced squadron, and Raymond, the group commander, Collishaw, used us for reconnaissance as much as anything else. Intermittent raids, but reconnaissance. When I say reconnaissance...
Do you remember any of these flights in particular?
Oh, yes, I do.
Well, tell us whichever one you want to do next. What's probably chronologically?
Chronologically, yes.
Well, pick one.
I'll just give you one, for instance. I was summoned by my own CO, Barney Kiley, again, because I was, I suppose, a good navigator, oblique bomb aimer. And this time I flew as an observer bomb aimer. And the exercise was to do an attack, a night attack, on El Adem Aerodrome, which was about 15 miles south of Tobruk. There were, four aircraft involved, but we were flying individually. So when we took off from Martin Bogush, same procedure, we were carrying fragmentation bombs in small bomb containers and incendiary bombs as well. So the drill was that we were to fly due south from Martin Bogush into the middle of the desert somewhere, and then pick up turn west and fly for a given period of time to another point in the desert, and then turn north, which the last leg should have taken us right out across El Adem airfield, and then turn east and come home. It was a long trip. I can't remember, it was about 3.5 hours or so altogether by the time we doglegged. But the thing that I remember most of this particular. It was the first time, only time I think I flew with the CO. Well, it was the only time I flew with the CO, is operationally. I'd flown with him once before at night. But so we had. Trouble with our identification lights when we took off. In the front cockpit of the Blenheim, there was a switch on the right hand side, which is down for on permanently, up for Morse, and middle is off, something like that. And this controlled the downward identity light and also the blue station keeping lights. The navigation lights were separate, I think. Anyway, we had some trouble with getting these blue lights switched off. And the guy who had taken off with us indicated that everything was okay. You know, I'd signaled or made gestures this year that everything was okay. So off we went to down this long dog leg. And I remember because we used to carry our tin hats with us in these days, believe it or not. We used to carry them in the aircraft. And we got down and we were drop bombing from about 500 feet. And there's no bomb doors to open, of course, because the bombs just fell out and there was no bomb doors on the aircraft. So down we go, and only to be received down on the target, flying south to north, up the airfield towards the hangars. And at this juncture, the light attack started, and it was flaming onions. I remember these things. The first time either of us had ever seen them. So I instinctively ducked, which brought a smile to the CEO's face. He saw me duck. Anyway, we've got such a...
Now, what were they? Can you just explain what they were? These
pardon?
These green... What were they?
Flaming onions. Well, it was a string of ACAC fire, which looked as if they were all tied together. It's a string, you know. Yeah, it came up in various colours. And we got quite such a shock because we didn't really expect it, for starters. And secondly, we're very fairly accurate. But anyway, we went down and we battered along the 500 and I dropped all those bombs. I missed the hangar, but they dropped in front of the hangar along the apron, so they obviously didn't do the guys any good. And then we peeled off and came home. And when we got back on the ground some hour and a bit later, we found the station keeping lights were still lit. And no wonder the ACAC was so accurate at 500 feet. So it was a lesson to be learned. We just had a good and bear. We were just lucky.
And that was flying with, who was the squadron? You were flying with the squadron commander?
Squadron commanders. Barney Kiley. Barney Kiley. He was shot down.
Kiley's
K-I-E-L-Y, I think, yeah. I've been in touch with his daughter. And he mentions me, and I've mentioned in his logbook, of course, naturally. But he was a nice guy. He was taken a prisoner. He bailed out and was taken a prisoner after I left the squadron, about the week after I left. But that was Barney. But he was a great guy. There's a picture, an official picture somewhere of him and I inspecting a bomb load underneath the aircraft. I was looking for it, actually, because it clarifies the small bomb container thing.
It's all right for now. We'll
yeah.
Now, any other rapes, specific raids you remember? Because I know you remember
two more.
Okay, tell us about them.
You've got enough time.
Yes, we're fine.
Two more. Well, the other one was quite interesting. Unfortunately, I haven't got my logbook, so I can't pin the dates down. But oh yes, I could pin the dates down because they're well documented by other sources. The group headquarters summoned a crew, which happened to be another pilot, myself, and a gunner, to carry out a reconnaissance of the Gulf of Bomba, which is way up the north coast of Africa. Beyond, it's a place called Derna, nearly to Benghazi. It's about 350 miles up from 350 miles up from Martin Baghouz westwards. And The brief which was given by the AOC was, take off in the dark, arrive over target at first light, and reconnoiter the base, the area, and take photographs if necessary.
Are you recognising the Gulf, i.e. the water? Are you recognising the water or the land?
Area.
The whole area.
Well,
land,
area.
And sea.
This is the Gulf of Bombay, which is, in fact, it's only a bay, literally, called the Gulf of Bombay. There's an island at the entrance. I'll come to it in a minute, actually, because
okay.
It's important. The geography is interesting. Anyway, the reconnaissance was to see what was going on. Obviously, AOC had intelligence, which he didn't divulge to me, obviously. And off I went, or off we went. And now, we took off in the dark, and being flying east to west, the sun was rising in the east. Of course, it was behind us, so it was to our advantage. So we came in very high and throttled back and glided down onto this bay. And what met our eyes when we got to this bay was the opposition had constructed a small pier which stuck out into the water, alongside which was moored a supply ship and a depot workshop ship. A depot workshop ship is a ship which has got a very wide beam. And it's very big, very big ship. Actually, it was a submarine repair ship. It so happened, and alongside that was moored a submarine. And standing off a few hundred yards away was another submarine, another two submarines, one which was estimated tonnage was about 1,200 to 1,500 tons, and a smaller one which was about 800 tons. And on the opposite side of the bay, close to the island, was a destroyer. So we come saddling out of the east, throttled well back, and all of a sudden the destroyer started firing at us. By this time we got down to about 4,000 feet. So we opened up, took some quick pictures, vertical pictures as we flew across the site, observed what we had to observe, made up our mind what we thought we had seen, and beetled off back home. Now, the funny part was that this young flying officer whom I was with, by this time my skipper had been killed or was missing, so I was flying as a gash. This guy was all for going around and shooting up this local airfield, which was a flying boat base, and I said, in no way, we had to get back with the pictures. So anyway, he agreed, and off we went back. So when we got back to Martin Bagouche, as we landed, a staff car followed the aircraft in. It was a staff car. And when we came to a halt, out pops from the staff car, jumps a sergeant who was a photographer, leaps up into the cockpit and says, did you get any photographs? I said, yes. I think I got some photographs. I've turned the last two exposures over, which was the drill you had to do to unload the camera. So he dived into the back end and turned the camera over again and took the magazine off, and off he went down to the group headquarters. The pilot and myself and the gunner were loaded into another vehicle and trundled down to the Holy of Holies, to wit, the Gruppenführer's hideout. And there was the group, Air Commodore Collishaw standing, and he personally conducted the debrief. So there was the captain of the aircraft, a flying officer, and myself, acting sergeant, standing, and an air gunner standing in a straight line in front of him. And he addressed all his questions to me, virtually, because I was the navigator. What did you see? And I went through the rigmarole of what I had seen. And are you sure that's what you saw? Yes, sir. Are you absolutely positive that's what you saw? Yes, sir. What do you say, flying officer so-and-so? And he said, yes, that's what we saw. And the wireless operator didn't have any comments to make. And just at the critical, he was writing all this down on a Bigsworth chalkboard with a Chinagraph pencil as he's scribbling. And just at the critical moment, in walks the sergeant with his dripping wet photographic print. And these days, you know, it just take about an hour to process them. And he presents it to the Air Commodore. And bang in the middle of it is this supply ship and this depot ship and this submarine and everything else. And he's rubbed his hands. And I remember in the back of the briefing room, there were three naval officers were standing in their immaculate whites. But in the, they were listening to the debrief, but they were right in the corner. And he called, he dismissed us and called these three guys over. And one of these guys was a Lieutenant Wellham, who was a former flight lieutenant in the Air Force, subsequently became a notorious for torpedo bomb. But these were three Swordfish pilots, and the three Swordfish were based at Martin Bagoosh, having been offloaded from, I think it was the HMS Glorious, which was in Alexandria Harbour undergoing some repair. So they gave these guys some work to do. They sent them up to Martin Bagoosh. The three Swordfish took off almost instantly, and they flew up to Sidi Barani, which is right on the border, for refueling. And then they were given a brief that they were, had to take off from Sidi Barani, fly out into the Mediterranean, due north, turn west as far out as they could go, and then come in south and attack these submarines. Well, they did just that, actually. And what in fact happened was that the story as it unfolded was that the submarines were carrying four crews for the human torpedoes, and Italian human torpedoes. They were preparing to attack Alexandria Harbour. And they had brought these across from southern Taranto district, southern Italy, in a, by the supply ship, and the submarine brought the submarines over, and they were all tied up getting the crews geared up. There were four crews, and when the torpedo bombers, the Swordfish, arrived on the site to make their attack, there was a big, this big submarine that we had seen was in the shallows between the island and the coast, and he was only in about 15 meters of water. He couldn't submerge when lo and behold the Swordfish appeared. So he chose to fight it out on the surface with the Swordfish, and he pointed himself directly. I saw he had the narrowest of target, but the guy who was flying the Swordfish, I think he was a commander in the Marines, he eventually launched his torpedo, which hit the submarine, and it blew up and sank in the shallows. Now, the other two aircraft went round the back and picked out appropriate targets and made attacks. In the end, the three torpedoes claimed, I think, five ships in the end. But the sequel to this was that this ship, which submarine which sank in the shallows, the reserve diving crew was back on the ship. So they rushed out and free dived on this wreck, and they established there were some people still alive inside doing the Morse code and things, knocking on the side. There were eight guys trapped in the submarine. So there was a big hoo-ha because all their diving gear was back at Tobruk. It hadn't been brought up. So they was touring and froing with transport. Some hours later, they dived, and they managed to have effect a rescue. Out of the eight, I think they got seven out. No, there was two drowned. What was that, seven, five, six got out. The two guys were panicked and tried to escape against the diver's instructions and got trapped in the in the escape hatch and lost their lives, but the others got out of it. Now, the guy who led the rescue, who was the fourth crew, the lieutenant, subsequently some 18 months later, led the raid on Alex Harbour, which damaged the HMS Valiant and a tanker, blew up a tanker and another major battleship. Was it the one of them? Damaged them, and he was taken prisoner. And when Italy changed sides and started to fight for us, he was elevated to the rank of admiral, and subsequently became a big wheel in the Italian Navy, and became a member of Parliament. And he was only he was decorated subsequently by the Commander in Chief for his services.
These were an Italian submarine depot ship.
Italian, yeah. I've got the details somewhere. I wrote some years afterward to the British Embassy in Rome, and I got a letter back saying, yeah, they couldn't provide me with information right now because it was just at the time the terrorist things were beginning to start up.
So this was a very successful reconnaissance indeed.
Oh, it was very, very successful. It was just a lucky shot. It was one of the other squadrons who had been doing a bombing raid had noticed this and reported it in the debrief, and I suppose the analysis went through. But then that was
now, it. You mentioned that you were flying with a different pilot because your pilot...
Yeah, I'd lost the Tommy.
Because I know you spent a lot of time with him. I know you think a lot of him.
Tommy.
Can you talk to me a bit about the loss of how you felt? How was Tommy not killed and how you felt about it?
Well, I'd flown with Tommy not for about, since I went to Egypt, 38 to 40, continuously. And we said, out of the 600 and odd hours at a clock top, I must have spent all 500 at least with him, honing our skills, as the phrase goes. And we were a good crew, navigation wise, bombing wise, and I suppose average at gunnery. But he was a great character. He was a rugby player for starters. He's a short. Don't know where he came from specifically. Must have been. But he was a clerk. A general duties boy apprentice clerk, 590277 was his number. It sticks in my mind. 590 being the serial number of all clerks. He was trained at Ruislip as a clerk, and he obviously, some time previous, because he was a sergeant pilot in 1938, so he must have been in a year or three before that. We all moved out on the troop ship together. He obviously was in Sergeant Smith then, but I didn't meet up with him until we got to Egypt. And I was teamed up with him, basically. And we had got on like a house on fire. And
now, you'd met his family, you know?
He was married, and I know that one of the Saturday morning dues, I met him in the Nafi compound with his wife and his two children. A little girl, she must have been about four, and the little boy must have been probably five or six. But we sat and chatted in the 1938-ish, sat and chatted in the confines of the Nafi. And then subsequently the families were evacuated about late 38 or thereabouts, and they went off to Palestine. Mrs. Knott went with the two children. Whatever happened to them, I don't know, because I heard subsequently that she had separated and gone off with some Palestine police officer, but I never had any more contact. Tommy and I flew all the time right up to the war, and because of the situation at the time, we had more aircrew gunners and navigators than we had pilots. So the pilots were working very hard, and I remember the day that he was lost was the day that the General Balbo was shot down. He was the Italian Air Force commander. He was either shot up on the ground or crashed or something. But the Italian Air Force were extremely hostile that day, and we lost five aircraft. Three from the squadron, of which Tommy Knott was one. And I didn't find out, he was posted as missing, and didn't know what happened to him. I had heard that he'd hit the sea on the way back, but I never found out till Graham Warner published his Blenheim book, and there's a little summary in there which says that he was attacked by Italian fighters and shot down into the sea, which was obviously very early on in 1940.
Now, how did you react to it? I mean, he was your
pilot.
Well,
I was very sad, obviously. Oh, despondent, I suppose, sad. Yeah, because he was a nice guy, and I liked him, and he had encouraged me over the years. It was really quite a blow, but it didn't make it didn't make any difference because, you know, I was just paired up with the first available for the next operation, and I soldiered on. I mean,
did you get another regular pilot, or were you with a lot of different pilots then?
I can't remember. I don't think so. I think I was a gash pilot, I think, more or less. Because Tommy Watt was my regular pilot. I flew with a CO. Well, that was obviously one of the sorties. I mean, he didn't do more than one a day. I don't know. I can't remember. I did about 25 sorties overall.
Now, are there any others you remember? I mean,
yeah,
you told us about
there's the ultimate. The ultimate, which ended up in the award of the Distinguished Flying Medal.
Now, tell us this, the whole, as much detail as you can, from start to finish.
Should I read you the citation to start with?
That would be good, but then, yeah.
The citation, this is the official citation signed by George the Sixth, George R.I., and it was hidden in the archive until somebody dug it out to me. And what it says, I'll read it in its entirety. It says, 550006, Acting Sergeant John Blair, number 113 Squadron, Middle East Command. Heading. Paragraph, on the 4th of September 1940, during operations over Derna, when the pilot of the aircraft was killed instantly by enemy action, Sergeant Blair, the observer, succeeded in getting the aircraft under control and taking evasive action while the air gunner fought off the enemy aircraft. Assisted by the air gunner, he then removed the dead pilot from his seat and, without previous flying experience, achieved a safe landing after a flight of 350 miles. By his courage, devotion and duty and determination, he saved the lives of both himself and the air gunner, as well as saving the aircraft. Now, that resulted in the immediate award of the Distinguished Flying Medal. And that was, as I said, dated, the official date is, in fact, 11th of September. And it's signed by...
So that's the date of the award.
The incident was the 4th.
That
photograph...
That's the story.
That photograph was taken the day after as a result of the...
Now, we'll come to the point. Yeah. Now, tell us the story in your own words, as you saw it. You were going on a raid...
Well, I've got it all here. So I just get my bits of paper.
You were going on a raid over...
No, I'll just tell you. I've got it all... Yes, I was. It was a daylight raid to the airfield at Derna, which is in the North African coast, about, as it says, 350 miles west of Martin Bagush. And